Good morning.
Good morning.
Can everyone hear me in the back? Yeah. I promise not to touch stuff. It was nice to hear music and singing to begin the service. Really appreciate that. So I'm going to talk about Jnana Paramita, the far-going mind-stream meditation. So it's appropriate that it starts with music because musical notes, sound, arises and disappears in a stream. As a child, I was very interested and secret codes. So I got interested in disappearing ink. And there used to be something called a Zen tablet. You could kind of get at the art stores where you'd kind of paint something for kanji or something, whatever you want, with a brush, and then it would disappear right away. Did I get that right? There's something like that, you know. Meditation I want to talk about is the profound meditation where we're with the flow of things arising and disappearing. Probably, it'd be a good idea if we did sometime water meditation, because one time my teacher had me write in water, right? Disappears immediately. Isn't that so? So in Jnana meditation, Jnana Paramita, we're not just noticing that things arise and disappear, but also recognizing where they come from and where they go. When we understand the rising and disappearing and where they come from and where they go, then we're doing Mahamudra style practice. Mahamudra means sometimes a great seal or a great gesture. Similar to another way we talk, which is Dzogchen, meaning great completion meditation. So the meditation we'll be doing later quietly is I'm going to ask people to notice their in-breath, breathing in through the nose, and then when your jaw's relaxed and you exhale, then you're dissolving the air into space, but not only that air, your CO2, but you're dissolving any kind of fixation in the space. So you're going out with the out-breath, leaving. It's what we're going to do when we die, so it's good to practice now. And then on the in-breath, we will come into ourselves. A few people here have been around when a baby's been born. So is our first breath an in-breath or an out-breath? Women will know this. Men might have to think about it. It's an in-breath, yes. You want your child to have an in-breath. So in one style of doing Dhyanaparamita meditation from a Mahamudra point of view, on the in-breath we come into ourselves, and on the out we arise, and then on the out-breath we disappear. We naturally see this anyway from an egoistic point of view. Generally, if someone criticizes us or calls our attention to something or we're startled, we kind of do an in-breath, don't we? We kind of come to ourselves. And then when we relax or we feel safe or the stress is over, out-breath. So, but even though we're doing it naturally, we're not present to, or was consciously present to what's happening, and we're not doing it fully. We're all doing it in a way correctly, but just not enough. So when we do an in-breath, we really want to bring the whole world in, and when we do an out-breath, we want to dissolve into the world. So we say in one of the verses that Talopa spoke to Naropa, phenomena, correctly understood, is Mahamudra itself. In our school, Vajrayana school, Tantrayana yoga school, we celebrate the phenomenal world. We're delighted with it. even when it disappears or doesn't appear the way we like it. So that's the important thing in Dhyanaparamita, unlimited meditation, Mahamudra, great seal meditation, is we're coming to ourselves and we're dissolving ourselves continually, and the world is coming into us and we're dissolving into the world completely, into the phenomenal world. But as we sometimes say in 12-step programs, there's nowhere it says you have to like it. So when we're fully attuned with this process as a whole, completely, as then we say in Dzogchen, then actually we go beyond like or dislike, and that's called Mahasukha, great bliss. So when we talk about great bliss, we're not talking about just, better samsaric pleasure. We're talking about the complete bliss of freedom and complete enjoyment by fully experiencing the arising and passing and understanding where things come from and where they go. It's absolutely necessary from in our school, from Tantra Yoga point of view, to generate this great bliss, because without that power and energy, it's difficult to sustain a wisdom mind. It's difficult to have enough energy to perform the bodhisattva activities. It sounds funny, but bodhisattvas take great joy in helping others. So it isn't just taking great joy in helping others from a moral point of view, like where I'm sad, you're sad, so I'll help you, but actually we're delighted to help others. And we're not just delighted to help others because it's the right thing to do. We recognize that our great bliss, combined with our wisdom of skillful means, is the best way to help others. So although we do generate empathy and compassion as bodhisattvas in the Mahayana world, we're also a little crazy happy at the same time. So that can be annoying because for outsiders, so to speak, Buddhists sometimes defined as insiders, because even when things are kind of crappy in the outside world, bodhisattvas are still generating the great bliss. So it's kind of horrible, but even when horrible things are happening, bodhisattvas are still generating great bliss. Does that sound uncompassionate? Difficult times, it's always samsara. So, many changes in America now, it's still just samsara, you know. So, that piece, on a fundamental level, we have to recognize. So, strangely, bodhisattvas are generating great bliss when things are terrible on a relative world, and generating great bliss when things are going well. This is difficult practice not because it's hard to generate great bliss when things are going badly, but when things are going well for us, it's very easy to slip into just regular kind of pleasure. It's really easy when things are going well that actually the mind becomes a little slack. We get a little bit lazy, so to speak. So even on our meditation, when things are going well, the mind becomes a little slack, it becomes less vivid. Sometimes this happens with artists and writers, but also happens with yogis. People generate a lot of great work musically or painting or art or meditatively, and then, you know, their kind of work slacks off a little bit. So sometimes we think, well, they need to suffer a little bit more. In our tradition, we don't say you need to suffer a little bit more, but you need to know that you need to then increase your energy so this ecstasy, bliss feeling remains very clean, clear. Because it's very easy when things are going well that we kind of settle down into a regular pleasure, which is relative, right? Regular pleasure is always contrasted with just, you know, like regular pain. I know you haven't heard lamas talk like this before, right? Nobody does. So usually we're saying, well, of course, when things are going bad, be cheerful. But actually, from a yogic point of view, from really deep practice point of view, the most difficult times are when we're complacent. And when we're just kind of coasting a little bit. It's when we're actually, usually when we're kind of like, example, driving, and we have a nice conversation in the car, it's going really nicely, so we miss the exit. Worst thing is missing the exit to the Bay Bridge. Have you ever done that? It's hard to get back on the Bay Bridge after. So, as people know, I like bridge metaphors because we're constantly in a state of transition. We're constantly moving through space. It's not solid the way we think it is. So we like, in Dharma, we like the word bridges a lot. So in our meditation today, Of course, we all want to feel good in our meditation, right? We all want to feel comfortable. You don't want to have aching back. You don't want to have, you know, bad knees. So we're going to generate, you know, the wish to have a relaxed body, generate the wish to, you know, just feel comfortable in our clothes. Hopefully our underwear is not too tight, you know, it's just right. But you don't want to put your mind on that regular comfort. We don't need to get rid of the regular comfort. We don't need to go to the other side and say, you know, as long as I'm in pain somewhere, I'm doing great practice. That's the opposite style. You don't need to do the hair shirt mea culpa style, you know. But we don't want to do mundane, regular pleasure either as a goal. I do want regular pleasure. So, of course, I want nice cushion myself, comfortable robe, so forth. But during the meditation, particularly Dhyana Paramita style, Mahamudra style, we also want to generate this great bliss, Mahasukha, based on the ability to understand and participate fully in arising and dissolving. So here we're not generating great bliss based on the Hinayana style of just liberation from samsara, right? Because that feels good, like, of course. So we think, great, I'm out of that mess. So I feel great, okay? And we're not just generating great bliss based on how wonderful it is to save all beings and wishing them to be happy, which is important, but still relative bodhicitta. We're keeping those. We're not getting rid of those. So I'm saying not just. But we're generating great bliss that's co-emergent with wisdom. This incredible joy and energy that's released when we you know, fully participate in creation and dissolution. This, of course, is when, you know, from tantric standpoint, you know, we become like devas, like gods, right? In fact, but in Buddhist point of view, actually, Buddha is devata deva, which means above the gods, right? Because we totally understand the process of creation and dissolution, and participate in it fully. From Buddha's point of view, after the gods or Brahma created material world, and I recognize this is sectarian, so it's okay. But then Brahma or the different manifestations kind of rested a little bit too long. A little bit became attached. So, you know, it became a little bit too subtly attached to the subtle, very subtle joy, instead of identifying completely again with the arising and dissolution process. So that there's just a tendency sometimes to human tendency to kind of linger a little bit, maybe. This is why doing martial arts or doing sometimes calligraphy where you can't change anything, watercolors, I guess, you know. If you linger too long, you're that's a problem, right? I don't know, is that true with watercolors? I don't know. Linger too long? Yeah, so the samsaric pleasures are always, I want to continue the past moment instead of letting the past moment dissolve so a new moment can arise. When we have the wisdom mind knowing where we arise and where we dissolve and that there will be something next, then we can let go and a new fresh moment will arise. But there's always some subtle kind of like, maybe I won't have another good moment. So I want to kind of a little bit hold on to that, or a little bit grasp onto, or try to program the next wonderful moment, instead of having the faith that out of the emptiness matrix, out of the Tathagata Garbha, the womb of the suchness, that the next moment of bliss and emptiness will arise. So when we're doing dissolving the breath into space, many times people find it's ridiculous, but we get worried that if we keep on exhaling a little bit, we might die. And we consciously take a breath. We go, I better breathe. Has anybody had that experience? Sometimes, you know, you're just letting go and you think, I was great, I'm just riding in the out-breath. And then a thought arises that, well, if I don't do something now, I won't breathe again. When you do the meditation, those who don't know what I'm talking about, you'll see. If you're paying attention, you'll start thinking, well, that's enough out-breath. I better take charge here and, you know, breathe in, because who knows? I just might keep going and then I'll fall over. It takes repeated training, actually, for the majority of us before we gain some wisdom and knowing, wow, I'm going to take another breath. Also, it takes some faith, even when we breathe in, that we can kind of stop breathing in. We can feel what it is to be full. So when we're breathing diaphragmatically, you're going to feel your fullness more than when you're breathing like chest breathing. It's hard to feel full when you're just breathing up here, okay? So I've talked a lot about proper vase breathing in the past, diaphragmatic breathing, but when we're using our diaphragm, then when you breathe in, your tummy goes out, right? Over the years, sometimes I've had people dispute that, actually. So I said, okay, stand up, let's see what happens. But no, when you breathe properly, when you breathe in, your tummy goes out. And at some point, you'll feel full. You will not keep breathing in until you burst. Sometimes people feel that, yeah, we're not attached to the, we're not worried about that we'll dissolve into space, but we're afraid that if we keep breathing in, taking the world in, so to speak, the world will kind of won't quit, you know, the world will keep coming in and will explode. Psychologically, that's called engulfment. Okay, there's, if I keep breathing in, you know, somebody will stuff something in my mouth and I'll explode or something weird, or I'll get choked on it, you know. So we learn we can breathe in, take in the world, and at just the right moment, we'll feel, okay, I got it. And then we can release. Our mind-body will know exactly when we've had enough breath, when we're full enough. We won't over-breathe. And that's really blissful. Now, someone has a question or comment or complaint.
That sounds very similar to Tonglin. Can Tonglin sort of help with that, being, you know, just breathing in at the world and then trying to get out, or am I not seeing it correctly?
Kind of, you know, Tonglin taking and, you know, sending and taking practice is like a Lojong practice, really, to get in touch with our mistaken self and self-grasping. So Tonglin is we're breathing in something that normally we wouldn't want to breathe in. So it's going against our usual kind of, I don't want to take in somebody else's poison. And then it strikes at our you know, fixations and then dissolves them. Yeah. So it's using, you know, it's helping us see stronger our self-fixation through the in-breath and the out-breath. Yeah. This is actually going beyond Tonglin, so. When people are quiet, it means I've completely made sense and everything. It's easy.
I don't
quite
understand.
Oh, good, okay.
I don't. It's dissolving. Can you dissolve the world? Or are you meditating on it?
When our attention rides on the out-breath, we're not just, it's not just our sense of attention, we're also letting our self-grasping, our sense of who we are, also dissolve with the breath. So we keep going out. We don't arbitrarily say, okay, I'm going to stop going out, or I'm going to do my in-breath now. We really surrender to our breathing cycle. So go all the way out until there's a natural coming back in. So in beginning meditation, usually there's a sense of a watcher. So we're a little bit distant. You know, we're here and we're watching our breath here. So we're staying here and we're watching our breath come in and out like that. But the watcher is here. That's important. Very beginning when we're really caught up in our drama. So that's when it's important. Get off the stage and get back in your seat, you know. But then the watcher becomes fixated. So we also have to dissolve the watcher. That's easy. Yes? Maybe it could be, but it's a also, you know, just a surrender. It's tricky because we want to watch ourselves dissolving the watcher. We want to be at our own funeral and see what people have to say about us. Okay, so dissolving the watcher means dissolving the watcher. In generally, in beginning meditation, in some sense, we have to strengthen the watcher, you know, to get off the stage, to get out of the drama, out of the confusion of our thoughts and emotions. So we step back a little bit. But then that watcher begins to solidify, you see. And then that's when people say, you know, like, I've attained it or something. Because then the watcher seems solid. You say, well, the watcher is not my ego, so I'm okay because I'm just the watcher. So when the Buddha came up with his anatman idea, non-self idea, really what he was criticizing is the tendency in yoga to then make the watcher aspect as absolute. Okay? Because that can become very strong. It is an aspect of mind, but you know, he said that's not that's a problem. That becomes you know, a fixated self, and then people just become watchers. Well, the watcher is just a watcher, you know. Okay. So, unfortunately, like, just an aside, you know, my old teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, used the word ego because he picked that up from psychoanalytic talk. And then the ego has become some kind of little demon. Psychoanalytically, ego just means the I consciousness, which you need, by the way. So we should technically say misperceived self or something like that. Yeah. We need a relative self. So the misperceived self, where we really mistakenly identify something and then is acting selfishly or with self-grasping, which is a slightly different word in Sanskrit and Tibetan too. But English doesn't have that many words for self, you know. It's just like the self, that's it. Yes.
Just to clarify a little, you're talking about, I mean, physiologically it's impossible to have this fear arising as we're exhaling, thinking, I have to take charge, I have to take charge, I'm going to die. It's physiologically impossible.
It's impossible to what?
We're not going to die. I mean, the body is set up.
Yeah, we're not going to. Yeah.
So when this fear is arising, yeah, with the thought that, you know, I have to take another breath, but if I don't take another breath, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. It's not based in reality.
No, not reality. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Yeah. So I you know, my interpretation is that the Buddha was really criticizing how in yoga we tend to advance to the point where we gain a very stable watcher, but then fixate and solidify that and then think that's the self. Yeah. Like that.
So it's not good to have a stable watcher.
A stable watcher is one step in the path. Yeah. Yeah. But you can't always be a watcher. Sometimes you have to be in the game too, right? Yeah. So we have to develop the wisdom mind to be balanced in the state of activity. You can't always be separate from what you're looking at. Yeah. If we're always separate from what we're looking at, we're always going to have some problem with what we're looking at. There's always going to be some kind of dualistic problem going on. We're always going to say, well, what's my strategy to relate with that? This is easy, right? Okay. So, personally, you know, like, we have many devoted Tantrika students here. The majority of talks in in America, you know, of course, are going to be talks from the side of relative dharma. You know, just be a good person, develop a strong, balanced relative self, relative watcher, and drive on that right-hand side of the road and be decent, which is I'm totally for. But it would be a shame for me to be here and not really speak to, you know, Prajnaparamita meditations, Mahamudra meditations, Dzogchen meditations as part of our daily practice. Otherwise, I'll be cheating you, and you'll be cheating yourself, you know. So don't be a perfect relative self. Just be a good enough relative self. Okay? And then when we're doing the absolute activities, then we develop the wisdom that it isn't the relative self that does it, yeah? It's your Buddha nature, your absolute self, that's doing the practice. The relative self is a wonderful reference point and an echo. It's very nice to be an echo. It's very nice to have a mirror, you know. I don't know when mirrors, you know, regular modern mirrors were developed. That must have been a really big deal, at least for cosmetic fashion industry, you know. They used to have to just polish metal. Yes.
Would it be an appropriate metaphor to say that a stable watcher is a tool to be used in some instances and to be left behind in other instances?
I wouldn't say tool, because then it's, you know, it's a skill in a way. Yeah, it's a skill, you know. Stable watcher kind of is like very profound. That's very profound shamatha, and can be very profound vipassana too. Like Taruko is a stable watcher for the kids, right? Like just kind of like there. So when I'm saying that, it's very profound. The point I'm making is that it's easy just to stop there. Developing some stability in our meditation, a sense of stable watcher, so to speak, you feel enlightened. You feel like you're done. You do. You feel like, oh my gosh, I'm done. This is it, you know. It's interesting when a lama like myself says, well, you're not done, it could be either, you know, insulting or discouraging, but for the people that have stuck around, it's actually inspiring. You say, really? I'm not, you know, I'm just at one ridge of Mount Everest, you know, like there's more to go. Real Bodhisattva goes, that's fantastic. You know, I thought I was all done, you know. But when there's still a lot of ego clinging, sorry to use that word, but there it is. When there's a lot of clinging that way, then we, our kleshas, our emotional immaturity is going to come up again. We're going to feel like, well, Lama Jima doesn't know shit because he said I wasn't enlightened, or maybe he's not enlightened, or you know, he's jealous or something, you know. Seriously, I've been doing this a long time. So I'll just go and get validation from another teacher or something. We have the ability to do this because, you know, Siddhartha fantastically studied with many incredible yogis and said, well, you know, I thank you very much, Alara Kalama and everybody, but it isn't, you know, quite it. You know, there's still a little bit clingy. I still don't feel like total liberation. You know, I'm still kind of watching a little bit, you know, like that. Of course, like in India at the time, there were many enlightened rishis, you know, and many Buddhas too, you know. There isn't just the one Buddha, of course, you know, but Siddhartha had such a big impact that, you know, we follow him. But it's very easy to take this very subtle, pleasurable state, very subtle, stable state, and say, then, you know, I've attained that goal. So that's why we have to be inspired to go a little bit further, actually. Because the view halfway up the mountain is so profound that it's easy to stop there. There's a wonderful book, it's called Halfway Up the Mountain. And some British sociologist put it together a number of years ago. You know, talking about teachers and students, you know, what happens when someone starts teaching when they're kind of halfway up the mountain, you know? Some of the problems, you know, with teachers and students, you know, in transmission halfway up the mountain. Because it's so incredible that you feel you want to just stop there. Yeah. Yes. Anybody else? Yeah. Oh, hi. Power of how? Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Well, stable watcher is where managed care wants us to stop. They'll say, you know, you've met your goals. We're not authorizing more sessions, you know. And yeah, okay. Okay. No. Sleeping well, you know, socializing. Okay. So, gone a little bit over, but I'd like to take time to stretch, and then we'll be back to do, you know, this style of meditation, okay? Just take 5-10 minutes, okay? Yeah, you can just stretch and talk. It's okay. Thanks for coming back. Okay, a few tips, maybe. It's very easy, growing up, Western scientific view, to equate the brain with the mind. So somehow we're locating awareness, over here. if we have to locate mind, we generally locate heart. Okay, so mind always has the aspect of emotional resonance at the same time. So we don't have enough words in English, you know. So we should be always saying, you know, heart mind. but also in Dhyana Paramita and Mahamudra, Dzogchen meditation, the whole body is the mind. Okay, so we definitely don't want to have, like, we're up here looking down at our breath. It's easy to do that, right? You know, kind of like I'm looking kind of down on my breath. So, you know, if you find yourself looking down on your breath, then sometimes it's easier to imagine your mind, lower than your belly button. So your mind is underneath your breath. It's still a relative state, but it's better to see mind supporting your breath than this top-down thing. That's easy, right? But generally, in Tantra style, the heart, it's the heart mind here. It does make you feel warm and fuzzy, doesn't it? Heart mind. Okay. So we've got some time now.